Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, within the next few days, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Dr. Gregory Gause with us today to discuss his council special report entitled Saudi Arabia in the New Middle East. Dr. Gause is professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Vermont. In 2009 and 2010, he was the Kuwait Foundation Visiting Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. From 1993 to 1994, he served as CFR's Senior Fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies, and his most recent book is The International Relations of the Persian Gulf. Greg, thanks very much for being with us today. Your report talks about how Saudi Arabia managed to avoid the turmoil of the Arab uprisings and the challenges it's facing vis-a-vis its current stability. It would be great if you could give us an overview of your analysis and the implications for U.S.-Saudi relations.
Sure. And thanks, everybody, for calling in. I do appreciate it. I think that one of the interesting points about the American perception of Saudi Arabia is that whenever there's upheaval in the Middle East, even though Saudi Arabia tends to avoid it, we immediately start to think that the Saudis are unstable. I think that this is something that goes back as far as the 1950s, and it bespeaks a fundamental, I don't want to say misunderstanding, but a fundamental suspicion in the American political class that Saudi Arabia, because it's a monarchy, because it is self-consciously based on a religious political legitimacy formula, if you will, is fundamentally unstable, and I think that the evidence is just completely against that. I mean, once again, we've seen a period of huge upheaval in the Middle East, in which Saudi Arabia, even though it experiences a lot of the same social and political problems that confronted a number of the other Arab countries that had major upheavals, the Saudis escaped with very, very little, if any, kind of public mobilization against the regime. I think that the simplest way to understand this is in terms of oil. When oil prices are high, the Saudi regime has quite a bit of money at its disposal, and it uses it strategically. But I think that it's more than just money. It's how the Saudis use that money. They use that money to reinforce both general patronage networks, but also specific political alliances that the regime has made that has sustained it over the decades. Alliances with the religious establishment, alliances with business communities, alliances with notables and tribal figures throughout the kingdom. And the Saudis, the Saudi regime basically mobilized all of those networks at a time of you know, enormous regional disquiet. So on to the larger question of the U.S.-Saudi relationship in, if you will, a post-Arab Spring Middle East, it seems to me that we and the Saudis have a number of common interests, but and this has always been the case, but I think it's brought into, it's been highlighted in the past year. While we have some common interests, we don't agree on everything. And I think that the most reasonable way to deal with the relationship going forward is to emphasize those things where we do have common interests, and I think that includes a common interest in the containment of Iranian power in the region. I think that it specifically includes stability and a successful political transition in Yemen. I think it also includes, to some extent, although I think our means might differ these days, we're on basically the same page vis-a-vis Syria. And I think that what we have to do is understand that there will be issues on which we will not be on the same page. I think Bahrain is a really important one that is not going to go away in the future. I think that the general position on democratic reform in the Arab world, which is something that the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it, while encouraging of, were also somewhat cautious about. The Saudis are not particularly encouraging of it, and that's something that I think we're just going to have to live with down the road. So I think that it's an extremely important relationship, one in which there continue to be important common interests, but also some differences of opinion that need to be acknowledged. And
I want to take some notes if there's anything that you don't.
I think that's really plenty for an intro, and I'd really like to hear what you folks think and your comments and your questions.
Great. Let's open it up just to questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key. That's star one on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they're received, and if at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the queue, just press star two. Again, to pose a question, just dial star one now. Our first question comes from University of Puget Sound.
So Saudi Arabia is a Sunni monarchy, and I was wondering if the Sunni politics in Saudi Arabia affect their perception of Iran, and if that contributes to any kind of inherent negative relationship with the Iranian Shia clerical state.
That's a very good question, because I think that the shorthand for understanding the balance of power game in the Middle East these days is Sunni versus Shia. And it's such a popular shorthand because it does capture, some amount of the dynamics, but it doesn't capture them all. I mean, I think that at the top, that is to say the Saudi elites, they view Iran less as a Shia power and more as a kind of a classic balance of power threat. And so I don't think that they're driven primarily by sectarian feelings. I think that they're driven overwhelmingly by the fear that Iran is ambitious, it's expanding its power, it's consolidated, this is the Saudi view, it's consolidated a leading position in Iraq, and it wants to do so in other states in the region. Now, the contest for influence between Saudi and Iran is played out in the domestic politics of weak states in the region, right? Iraq after our invasion, in Lebanon, classically, among the Palestinians, and in other places, and now increasingly, I would say, in Syria. And within the domestic politics of those countries, kind of in places where there are Shia and Sunni, the Shia are the natural allies of Iran, and the Sunnis are kind of the natural allies of Saudi Arabia, and thus, in those particular conflicts, those domestic conflicts that the Iranians and the Saudis are involved in, it really is a very sectarian domestic political battle, and thus, the overall temperature of the sectarian tensions in the region have gone up enormously in the last couple of years, and it's extremely dangerous. But overall, I think that the Saudi approach to Iran is less driven by sectarian feelings, although they're willing to exploit those sectarian feelings against Iran in particular contexts like Lebanon or Syria, and it's more driven by balance of power. One of the reasons I say this is that it's not so long ago that Iran and Saudi Arabia basically had pretty decent relations. Even after the Islamic Revolution, during the presidencies of Hashemi Rafsanjani and Mohammad Khatami in Iran, Saudi-Iranian relations were correct. They were okay. I wouldn't call them warm, but they were certainly they were correct, and they weren't dominated by a region-wide rivalry. So I think that the sectarian element is really important for understanding this, but I don't think it's the major driver.
Great question, thanks.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, simply dial *1 on your touch-tone phone now.
Greg, you mentioned many medium to long-term challenges facing Saudi Arabia in your report. Are there any short-term challenges presently that are particularly significant for the stability of the regime?
Well, the thing that gets pointed to the most in the Western media is the age of the top leadership. And they're all old guys. There's no question about that. And there is a question about the health of the king, the health of the crown prince, who comes after. There's always speculation in a monarchy about that. I actually don't think it's all that important for two reasons. One, there's a long tradition in the Saudi family of kind of not undoing what your predecessor has done. I mean, there's been a pretty consistent line on policy toward the United States, of looking to the United States as a major security ally. And I don't think that changes from king to king. You might get more change at the domestic level, but even there, I think that outsiders tend to exaggerate the effect of a new king. Secondly, outsiders have a really, really bad track record of predicting how Saudis are going to act once they get into positions of power. I'm old enough to remember when every American expert on Saudi Arabia just knew, absolutely knew, that then Crown Prince Abdullah was traditional and tribal and anti-American. And that was just the conventional wisdom. And that's certainly not the way he governed. So it seems to me that we tend to overemphasize succession. I don't think it's a short-term issue. I think it's a medium-term issue, because at some point, the Saudis are going to have to transition to the next generation of leadership, right? Leadership has been in the sons, the generation of the sons of the founding king of the modern Saudi kingdom, and they're running out. And we have no precedent for a move to the next generation. That, I think, could be a difficult transition for the Saudis, but I don't think that's coming, in the short term.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from St. Edward's University.
You mentioned earlier that Saudi Arabia and the United States have a common interest in Iran, but you don't necessarily hear Saudi Arabia coming out against Iran. What do you see as Saudi Arabia going forward with help in relations to the United States and sanctions against Iran or whatever action they will take?
Sure. I think that the Saudis are publicly on board on things like maintaining supply in the oil market if there's disruption of Iranian supply as a result of sanctions. The Saudi oil minister has said that. The Saudi government has said that. Where the Saudis are more reticent, and where I think that there's more division within the leadership in Saudi Arabia, is on the whole question of a military strike on Iran. There, I think that you get people in Saudi Arabia who are very enthusiastic about supporting a military strike on Iran and Iran's nuclear programs. But you also get people who are very wary of a military strike on Iran, because they fear that they'll be the first target of Iranian retaliation. And I think that there are those divisions within Saudi public opinion, elite opinion, but probably at the very top levels as well. I think that the Saudis ideally, would like to have the U.S., quote-unquote, take care of Iran, but with absolutely no repercussions for them. But that's magical thinking. That just can't happen. So it seems to me that the Saudis will be very cautious on military issues, but they are pretty out front on confronting the Iranians in Syria right now, and they have been pretty public about their willingness to act in the oil markets to try to increase the pressure on the Iranian economy.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Georgetown Law Center.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay, so my question is that the U.S. government has always been an ally to the royal family in Saudi. So let's say a revolution arises in the future. The U.S. has been notoriously known of either being passive or acting selfishly within the area of the Middle East. How would the U.S. react in the case of revolution? Would they support the people, or would they just care about their interests in oil?
Well, I think that the U.S. does act selfishly in the Middle East, and I don't think that it's any different from any other world power. We might talk a different game, but I think that we're driven by self-interest in the same way that every world power throughout history has been driven by self-interest. The question is always, how do you define your self-interest? One of the things that seems clear to me in the last 50 years of American involvement in the Middle East is that the United States doesn't think that it can do much to help an ally when that ally is confronted by a massive popular uprising. U.S. did very little, or could do very little, you know, one could argue the definitions here, to help the Shah in 1978-79. It did very little to help Mubarak. It stood by Mubarak, but did very little to help him, and in the end kind of couldn't save him, and is dealing with the new Egyptian government. My guess is that the same thing is the case for Saudi Arabia. If the United States thought that the Saudi regime were actually collapsing, I don't think that there would be and collapsing in the face of a domestic political upheaval, there's really not that much that the United States can do, right? And it would deal with whatever came after. But it seems to me that what the United States is good at is that if there are international attacks across borders, as Saddam Hussein's attack on Kuwait, there the United States is extremely good at being able to mount major armed forces to push back hostile attacks on its allies. So I think that's the big difference in terms of American military, the use of American military force in this area. But, you know, the Saudis don't seem to be in a position where they're going to have to face, you know, that difficult popular upheaval anytime soon. Right? If it didn't happen in 2011, when the rest of the Arab world, or much of the rest of the Arab world, was in flames, it seems to me that the Saudis probably are going to be pretty stable, at least in the short term. And I think as long as oil prices are over $100 a barrel, the Saudi regime has the money to maintain its alliances, its domestic alliances and patronage networks, and to maintain its economy at a level that it can sustain its domestic stability. But, you know, if a scenario occurs where the regime seems to be falling, and it seems to be falling because of domestic political upheaval, I think that past cases indicate that there's not much the U.S. will do in that case.
Great. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Virginia Tech.
Hello.
Hi.
Earlier you talked about the roots of conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if, rather than a sectarian-based conflict, do you think that the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran is due to a perception in Saudi Arabia that the Islamic Revolution and the model established in Iran poses a threat to the system of government in the Gulf state monarchies?
I think that was definitely the case in the immediate post-revolutionary period. All of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and the smaller states, basically backed Iraq in its war against Iran, largely, I think, because they saw the Iranian model as a threat to their own domestic regime stability and security. I think that sense of threat dissipated in the 90s and into the 2000s when the Iranian regime went through, the revolutionary regime went through a period of consolidation. Its own diplomacy became much less revolutionary, much more conventional, if you will. And there was decent state-to-state relations, as I mentioned before, during the Rafsanjani and Khatami presidencies in Iran. I think the Saudis perceive the current power configuration in Iran as being more supportive of larger revolutionary goals, kind of a throwback to the immediate post-revolutionary period. And they see, again, this is my sense of their perception, they see Iranian influence spreading in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Yemen, and they see Iranian efforts to affect events in the Gulf states. And thus they see it as something of a throwback to that immediate post-revolutionary period where the Iranian regime, kind of full of revolutionary zeal and the confidence of its own success in overthrowing the Shah, did encourage similar popular upheavals in other Middle Eastern states.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Pitzer College.
Thank you very much. My question is with respect to the role of China. The Chinese have come in now into the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia is already selling oil to China. And my question is, how does this play out in terms of the Saudis having an alternative to a major power that can supply them with weapons?
Right. That's a very good question and a matter of quite a bit of speculation these days. My take on it is that the Chinese are not enthusiastic about replacing the United States as the major geopolitical player in the Gulf, largely because they see the cost that entails. The Chinese are, I think, if I would describe their policy in the Gulf right now, it's much less involved with strategic position and much more involved with access to energy markets. And thus, they have very good relations with the Saudis and very good relations with the Iranians, both of which are major energy suppliers to China. The Saudis see China first and foremost as their growth market for the future, for their major export of oil. They know that energy demand in Europe has basically flatlined. And they see East Asia and South Asia, that general kind of crescent from India over to China, as being the growth area for their business. And thus they have cultivated, especially under King Abdullah, have cultivated very close economic relations with the Chinese. And the Chinese are investing in natural gas operations in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, and Chinese business presence in Riyadh has grown exponentially over the last 10 years. It's a thriving economic relationship, but the Saudi elite realizes that China is not a military substitute for the United States. It can be a source of weapons. It was in the mid-80s when the Saudis bought the SS-20 missiles from China, and China can be a source of weapon sales, but China doesn't have the Air Force, it doesn't have the Navy to actually be able to project power into the Gulf region now or in the foreseeable future. And thus, the idea that China could serve as an alternative to the United States as a strategic ally, as opposed to, say, a source for arms sales, is not on the cards yet.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Claremont Graduate University.
Thank you so much. I really like this analysis, and I have a question according to the consequences of the Arab Spring. Do you think that the United States think that the Sudan stability is the key issue in the Middle East, you know, because the neighbor of Saudi Arabia now, you know, the moving towards, you know, religious government, it's really supporting the position of Saudi Arabia, and look to the consequences if we also keeping Saudi Arabia, or increase the military spending or helping Saudi Arabia to be above Iran and other challenger of U.S. policy. So this is why it can keep Saudi Arabia as a dominant, stable country compared to the case of Egypt now.
Right. Well, I think that the issue of Saudi political stability is not something that's questioned at the top levels of the administration right now. I mean, I think that if they had any thoughts about Saudi stability last year when Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen were blowing up and Libya were blowing up, and then Syria, I think those questions have been at least in the short term answered. We certainly don't see an American policy right now that gives any indication that Washington thinks that the Saudis are unstable. I mean, they're going ahead with a big arms sale. The president consults regularly with the king. And so it seems to me that there's no question in Washington in the immediate term about Saudi stability. Now, I do think that there are questions in Washington about the extent to which American and Saudi interests overlap. And I think it's on a couple of issues. One is the general issue of democracy. The United States is, at least rhetorically, still committed to this notion that it supports democracy in the Arab world, even though democratic elections in the Arab world are producing governments that might not be all that friendly to the United States. And the Saudis are obviously not particularly committed to that notion, particularly in monarchies. And the Saudis do seem to have come out of the Arab Spring with a kind of a principled position that they will support any monarchy against a popular upheaval. Certainly that was the case in Bahrain. But you also see them reaching out to Jordan in a way that perhaps has not been the same since the Jordanians sided with Saddam Hussein during the 1990-91 Gulf War, with the invitation to Jordan to join the Gulf Cooperation Council, even the outreach to Morocco. So on that score, the U.S. and the Saudis are probably not on the same page. In terms of the rise of both Salafi and Muslim Brotherhood political groups within the Arab world as a whole, I'm not so sure that the Saudis are as enthusiastic about that as one might think just from you know, kind of looking at their own political system. First off, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudis have had a checkered relationship. And while the Saudis were very supportive of the MB in many places, including Egypt, when they saw their main threat is from the left, from Arab socialism, from Gamal Abdel Nasser, from the Soviet Union in the Cold War, they had a falling out with many of the Muslim Brotherhood groups during the Gulf War of 1990-91. And the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Prince Nayef, has publicly, on more than one occasion, kind of blamed the Muslim Brotherhood for everything that's gone wrong in the Middle East. So there's no automatic kind of complementarity of interest between Muslim Brotherhood groups in Saudi Arabia. It'll be very interesting to see how the Saudi-Egyptian relationship develops. Even on the Salafi question, I think that this is a really mixed blessing for Saudi Arabia. On the one hand, Egyptian Salafis, Syrian Salafis, they might look to Saudi Arabia as a natural ally, as a Salafi government, which it is. But on the other hand, the idea of Salafi groups participating in democratic processes, running for election, in essence abandoning the old Salafi position that democracy was a Western innovation and not something that Islam needed, and basically coming around to the position that many Muslim Brotherhood groups had come to, which is that, you know, democratic forms are compatible with their notions of an Islamic state. That creates long-term problems for Saudi Arabia. If you have Egyptian Salafis and Yemeni Salafis and Libyan Salafis all saying, yeah, the democratic politics, they're fine with us and we're happy to participate, well, how long will it take before some Saudi Salafis start raising the same issues? And we already see some hints of that in some of the petitions that were circulated in Saudi Arabia during the last year.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Hello. My name is Brian. I'm a student at San Diego State. I was interested in a little bit what you've been talking about. Do you see monarchy lasting 10 or more years in Saudi Arabia? And as well. Could you talk a little bit about Saudi involvement in Syria? You didn't mention it that much in your publication, and you mentioned that they might be financing Syria because it's a non-governmental, going to non-governmental organizations, the funding isn't as clear. So I was wondering about that and how that plays into their sort of competition with Iran for involvement in the Middle East.
Sure. Let me take the second part first. I think that the Saudis view the events of the Arab Spring largely through the lens of their regional competition with Iran. Right? Partially, they view the events of the Arab Spring through their desire to maintain fellow monarchies. But beyond that, I think even more importantly is that they view these events through the lens of their competition with Iran. And thus, Hosni Mubarak falling is very bad because he was their closest ally in the Arab world vis-a-vis Iran. Whereas, you know, the fall of Hafez al-Assad, there's a slip for you, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria would benefit them in terms of their geopolitical competition with Iran, because Bashar al-Assad is Iran's closest Arab state ally. It seems to me that that is the driving force. They're viewing this through the geopolitical lens of their competition with Iran. And thus, I think that since I wrote the piece, it's become clearer and clearer that the Saudis have taken a very public position in support of the uprising in Syria. I assume that that means, and again, I don't have any hard evidence on this. I think it's from public sources very, very difficult to get hard evidence on this. But my assumption is that Saudi support is going to elements of the Syrian opposition, both inside the country and outside the country. Certainly the Saudis have been, with the Qataris, the most public in terms of calling for outside support, even military support, for the Syrian uprising. So I think that kind of the you know, whatever hesitancy the Saudis might have had at the beginning of the Syrian uprising has fallen away, and I think that they're kind of fully in trying to bring down the regime of Bashar al-Assad. All right, the first part of the question was about monarchy and the future of monarchy. And that's a very interesting point, because there's a kind of a thread in the Western media analysis of the Arab Spring that says, well, the monarchies did fine. It must be because they're monarchies. It must be because monarchy is somehow culturally or politically suited to the politics of the Arab world. I actually don't think that's the case. I think the monarchs have succeeded in the Arab Spring largely because of the strategic choices that they've made. You know, for a number of them, obviously, oil has allowed them to both co-opt and contain political mobilization in their states. In Bahrain, monarchical solidarity helped the regime stay in power against a massive popular uprising against it, with the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris sending troops to support the Bahraini monarchy. But even in Morocco and Jordan, I think it's less that they're monarchs and more the policy choices they've made that can explain why they were better able to deal with this year of upheaval than their neighbors were. If we look at the broader picture of the Middle East, this is a place that has not been particularly kind to monarchs. Since the end of World War II, we've seen monarchs fall in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Iraq, in South Yemen, which former British colony of South Arabia, and then beyond the Arab world in Iran, and so if you want to go even further afield, Afghanistan. So it's not that there's a some kind of automatic affinity for monarchy in the region, I don't think. Plenty of monarchs have fallen. I think to understand the longevity of these monarchs, we've got to go a little deeper and ask what kind of alliances have they made, what kind of political economy strategies have they adopted, and what kind of leadership strategies have they used, and what kind of international alliances have they forged.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Adelphi University.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Naresh Singh, student at Adelphi. I heard that you mentioned that the Saudis support any monarchy against popular upheaval, and in this case, we're talking about democracy. So is this based more on the presidential democracy, like the presidential democracy model, like the United States, or a parliamentary democracy model like Britain or France?
Right. I think that the Saudis are leery of any kind of democratic model. They are the only country in the world, I think, that doesn't have even kind of sham elections to a national parliament. Right? Their parliament is appointed, and it doesn't have full legislative powers. And so it's not so much, you know, presidential or parliamentary. I think that they think that they have a stake in the stability of the remaining monarchs in the Middle East, particularly those monarchies that are on their borders, which is to say that their fellow members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, and then to their north and west, Jordan. And I think that they made clear during the events of 2011 that they would do everything in their power to maintain the stability of monarchical regimes. And I think it has less to do with worries about the development of a parliament in Kuwait or the parliament in Jordan. I mean, many of these places, many of these monarchies have had parliaments for a while. I think that the Saudi elite sees the preservation of the monarch at the top of the system as part and parcel of both their foreign policy and of their own domestic regime security. And thus, I think it really is tied up with both. I mean, take the case of Bahrain, where I think you can see Bahrain in two ways from the Saudi perspective. One is a fellow monarch, right, facing popular upheaval. We're gonna support the monarch. And then the other perspective is Bahrain is a country with a Shia majority. If you get real democratic politics in Bahrain, you're going to have Shia political control. They're going to look to the Iranians for support, and we're not going to allow that to happen at a time when we see Iran as a major geopolitical threat. And so on Bahrain, it was kind of the double whammy. It was the monarchy factor and the Iran factor both pushing the Saudis to take the hardline stance that they did. And I think that not every case has both of those factors, but I think that both of those things are at work in Saudi support for fellow monarchs.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ohio State University.
Hello? Are we hearing from the Ohio State University?
I hope so. Jeff, are you, is the line open?
Yes, the line is open, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Herman, you may have stepped away from
this.
Hello? All right, there we are.
All right, sorry about that. So there's been some speculation as to a nuclear arms race in the Middle East if Iran were to procure nuclear weapons. How do you think Saudi Arabia would act in that issue, seeing as how there's some speculation as to whether or not nuclear weapons have already been introduced to the Middle East, you know, through Israel and even through Turkey? Do you think Saudi Arabia would then pursue a nuclear program if this were to happen?
That is, as they used to say in the old days, the $64,000 question. There are indications both ways. My guess is that the Saudis haven't made up their mind. We know from WikiLeaks that, and from some public interviews with prominent Saudis, that there are certain there are certainly people in Saudi Arabia who are talking about the idea that if Iran's nuclear program develops into a nuclear weapons capability, that Saudi Arabia will have to do the same. On the other hand, there are also analyses out there, one by a CFR fellow, Steve Cook, just this week or last week. He wrote a piece on the Middle East channel at foreignpolicy.com that basically said that the Saudis wouldn't proliferate even in the face of an Iranian proliferation step, and he didn't think the Turks would or the Egyptians would. So I think this is an active debate. For me, I don't know. Right? I don't know what the Saudis will do if the Iranians actually do go nuclear. But it seems to me that the most important factor that will play into the Saudi decision at that point will be their relations with the United States. If they think that their relations with the United States are good and that the U.S. is a reliable security ally, then our admonitions against proliferation to them, I think, will carry a lot of weight. If, for whatever reason, the Saudi elite perceives that the United States is not a credible ally, then I think that vastly increases the likelihood that they'll try to develop a nuclear capacity. Now, the next step for them and the next big question is how. They have no indigenous nuclear infrastructure in Saudi Arabia. There's some small research programs, but they're completely under the International Atomic Energy Agency guidelines. They're very small, and there certainly hasn't been the kind of government commitment of massive resources to the nuclear program that we've seen in Iran. So if the Saudis wanted to obtain, they would have to try to obtain from an existing nuclear country, and all indications and speculation point to Pakistan, with which Saudi Arabia has had a very close security relationship for decades. Much speculation that the Saudis were financially supportive of the Pakistani nuclear program, and so that would also be a place to look. Would the Pakistanis be willing to provide Saudi Arabia with a force? And that's also a very open question.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from KFUPM.
Yes, in your analysis of the stability of Saudi Arabia, you emphasize four clear dimensions: buying loyalty, security forces, mobilization of network, and also division among reformers. But don't you think that you underestimate, or let's say you did not mention that much about other dimension, example, legitimacy, or indeed the Saudi political culture?
Jeffy, is that you?
That's right.
How are you doing?
How are you? I'm also glad to see the outcome of your report coming that way, and we are looking for something more. We are looking for a book, inshallah.
Inshallah, I'm looking for a book too. So I think that the issue of legitimacy is one that's extremely interesting and theoretically important. I come down on the side that says that it's very hard for us as analysts to judge the level of legitimacy in countries that are authoritarian, because it's difficult to tell what people really think about the government. You know, it's hard to ask people, you know, to do a survey, a public opinion survey, say, you know, do you think your government's legitimate or not? Well, I mean, in an authoritarian state, you put yourself at risk when you say no, I don't think the government's particularly legitimate. I certainly acknowledge that there are many, many people in Saudi Arabia who think that they are governed legitimately by the Al Saud family. There's no question about that. But I would also say that particularly in the Eastern Province, in the Hejaz, there are people who would question the historical legitimacy of the Al Saud to rule in their particular areas. So I think the whole legitimacy question is a mixed bag in Saudi Arabia. I think that what the Saudis have is what some people have called, you know, performance legitimacy. They've delivered, right? They've delivered a relatively stable political system. They've delivered at least some amount of economic development and growth, more in some areas of the country than in others. But they've delivered, you know, some amount of economic development and growth and economic prosperity in at differential levels throughout the country. I think on that level, the Saudis score particularly well, given the comparison to their neighbors, the chaos in Iraq after the invasion, the problems in Libya, the revolt occurring in Syria right now. And I think that that's a very strong argument that the Saudis make. You know, look at the alternatives, right? It will be very interesting to see 10 years from now if the Arab Spring does produce some stable democratic governments in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and who knows, perhaps even in Syria. If 10 years from now we see that, I think it might be harder for the Saudis to make this kind of comparative claim. Well, look at these other places. They're so messed up. We're giving you a better political system.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Georgetown Law Center.
Oh, hello. So going back to what you said about the monarchy system in the country, the argument has always been that Saudi Arabia cannot adopt a democratic system given the tribal structure of the people and their mindsets. What do you think? I mean, theoretically speaking, we know that the country is stable right now.
Yeah. I don't think tribalism is a bar to democratic politics at all. I mean, I think people make alliances across groups in democracies all the time. I think that tribes have accommodated themselves to democratic politics in all sorts of places. And so, yeah, I don't see tribalism necessarily as an absolute block to democratic politics. I think that we can see the way tribalism might work into a democratic parliamentary political system in Saudi Arabia by looking at Kuwait, where tribes tend to run tribal primaries, put up their own slates of candidates. The tribe kind of acts almost as a political party in Kuwait. Some people in Kuwait find that kind of debilitating toward their democracy. But others in Kuwait say, well, that's the system. If people want to vote that way, they should be able to vote that way. So I think tribes are actually incredibly adaptable to various kinds of political systems. And I think they've adapted to monarchy just fine, and I think they have adapted to democratic forms in other places just fine too. So I don't think tribalism as an obstacle to a democratically elected legislature in Saudi Arabia. I'll go beyond that a little. I do think that one of the longer term consequences of the Arab Spring is that it's just going to be harder and harder down the line to make non-democratic arguments for your own political legitimacy in the Arab world. I think before 2011, there were all sorts of non-democratic arguments that were made by all sorts of regimes for why, people should basically accept them as their rulers, right? The if I could call it the Mubarak argument, right, of provided stability and things could be a lot worse, so, be happy with what you have. I think that 2011 blew those arguments up. And as I mentioned earlier, the Salafi argument against democracy, which had been very, very strongly articulated, seems to be shifting. And so I think it will just be harder and harder for systems like Saudi Arabia to avoid some kind of democratic element down the road. In 10 years, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see an elected Majlis al-Shura in Saudi Arabia, an elected parliamentary body. And I think it would function much like the Kuwaiti parliament in that it would be problematic for the rulers, but, you know, they would live with it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Texas A&M.
Hello. Thanks for the program. I appreciate Professor Goss and the council both. I was curious, you had mentioned regional alliances and leadership roles, and I was wondering if you had any perceptions of how the Saudis view Turkey. I know that tomorrow there's going to be some non-proliferation discussions held in Turkey, and there's been a lot of reporting of the new role of Turkey in establishing a leadership role within the region. My guess is there's a lot of sensitivity to that in Saudi Arabia, but I'd like to hear your views on that.
Sure. I mean, I think that the Saudis see it as a very much a short-term positive, because they see, you know, an expanded Turkish role in the region as a balance against Iran. They're on the same side with the Turks on the Syria question right now, so they enjoy having a major regional power on their side in this question. And so I think on the short term, they're very happy to see a renewed activist Turkish role in regional politics. Now, further down the line, I think the Saudi view of a major Turkish role will depend a lot on circumstances. I think as long as the Saudis see Iran as their major geopolitical threat in the region, they'll welcome an active Turkish role. If something changes in Iran or something changes in the Saudi-Iranian relationship, where the Saudis don't see Tehran as significant a geopolitical threat, then they might not see the need for. Well, they might see Turkey as kind of horning in on areas where the Saudis would like to exercise more direct influence, whether it be in Syria itself, perhaps, or in Iraq. But I think in the current circumstances, the Saudis are very happy to have the Turks in, because the Turks, you know, end up on their side on at least the big question right now, which is Syria.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Claremont Graduate University.
Yes. Actually, I'm seeing in your report, the last page, which is 32, you think that the United States is still hesitated to see Saudi Arabia is stable or not stable. Mm-hmm. And I think, for the last analysis we've done here in Claremont, we found Saudi Arabia by far is stable comparing to the other regimes in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And I think my decision in the future will give China, I would say, like a good advantage to deal with Saudi Arabia and, you know, making that transition of global power. So this is not like, you know, threats the U.S. interest for future.
Right.
But so this is very, very, I would say, it's very, a critical question, you know, in the Middle East now, seeing if the United States does hesitate, you know, or is very hesitated, you know, look to Egypt, and you know, the consequence of that might can hurt the U.S. interest. What do you think about that?
Right. I don't detect any sense within the American government itself that there are questions about Saudi stability. There are always questions raised about Saudi stability by outside analysts. I think largely because the Saudi system is so different from the American system, and American assumptions about the anachronistic nature of monarchy are very, very strong. And I think there's a real block, actually, for most Americans to appreciate the resources that the Saudi state has and the stability that it has achieved. I mentioned at the outset of the hour that in almost every major regional crisis, you'll find people in the United States saying, "Oh, the Saudis are unstable," even though the Saudis came through the crisis with their stability intact. So I think that that's more about America than it is about Saudi Arabia. On the larger China Saudi question, I detect among Saudi elites a real hunger for alternatives to the United States. Right, I think that they see the United States as an important, even an essential ally, but one one that does really stupid things. You know, and obviously the Arab-Israeli stuff is a constant here, but more the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, which was, I think, seen by the Saudi elites as just a completely self-defeating and negative action. And I mean, to this day, I think that it's hard for them to explain to themselves how that could have happened. And thus, there is kind of a pining almost among the Saudi elites for an alternative great power that they could rely on. But they're also realistic. I mean, they know that China is nowhere near capable of being the kind of military power in the Middle East region that the United States is now. Maybe in 20 years, China will be, in which case the Saudis will have greater choices. But in my conversations with them, they seem to reluctantly acknowledge that day is far down the road, and they've got to live with their relationship with the United States because the alternative is even less attractive to them.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Virginia Tech.
Hi. I'd like to ask about basically human rights in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. especially pertaining to treatment of women.
Yep.
And also treatment of foreign workers, particularly those of India. And if the Saudi government, did they acknowledge these issues and have any sort of action plan as far as quelling concerns, pressures from either internally or external sources on trying to improve these human rights problems that they might be having?
Right. I think we have to take these two issues as completely different. In terms of foreign workers, the condition of many foreign workers in Saudi Arabia is not good, particularly domestics. There have been a number of reports on this. The Saudi government has only recently begun to acknowledge that there might even be a problem here. But there are new human rights organizations in Saudi Arabia that have at least tentatively taken up the issue of some of the foreign labor, of rights violations of foreign labor. And while I would hardly say that the situation is good, at least there's some acknowledgement of it. Now, that being said, most foreign labor in Saudi Arabia is there because they can make a much better living than they can back home. And it's not like people are forced in large numbers to work in Saudi. I think that there are specific professions, like domestic service, where one hears the kind of the worst stories of abuse, and they're anecdotal, of course, but you know they need to be dealt with. The first step on that is the Indian government itself, or the governments of other countries, and there's been some real tensions here. I mean, in some cases, like Malaysia, the government said we're not going to encourage people to go to Saudi Arabia anymore unless steps are taken to solve these issues. But for the most part, foreign labor is in Saudi Arabia because it can make a better life for itself. And you know, the pull factor of Saudi economic growth is such that I think that they'll, you know, they will not have any problem getting labor to come into the kingdom for the foreseeable future. Women's issues are completely different because that's about domestic Saudi citizens. It's about the folks who live there. And I really think that women's issues are the third rail of Saudi politics, right? If we say that Social Security is the third rail of American politics, you know, any politician who touches it gets electrocuted. Women's issues are the third rail of Saudi politics. They are tied up in an enormously complicated way with the self-image of the Salafi religious movement in Saudi Arabia. And thus, women's issues are a political football that men kick around. The driving issue is the most symbolic. I mean, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women are not permitted to drive. There's nothing inherent in Islam about this. Women drive in Muslim countries all over the Muslim world. But this has become a highly symbolic issue for the religious elites in Saudi Arabia and for people who adhere to the Salafi Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. And the government is very leery to touch this. I mean, in many ways, King Abdullah has taken some very interesting steps to try to increase the role of women in the public life of Saudi Arabia, including much more high profile for women in the press, including the appointment of a woman deputy minister of education, including, you know, the symbolic stuff of being photographed with women, unveiled women, at public events, of encouraging women as well as men to go abroad on the scholarships that the king has sponsored, of encouraging a more public role for women in the workforce, although that's going very slowly, and in some public events. So the king is very much, by the Saudi context, a progressive on women's issues. But he is hemmed in by, you know, very strong social forces that are opposed to any kind of change on women's issues. And that's it's an extremely volatile and symbolic political issue in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I am afraid we are out of time, and I'm sorry to those of you that we couldn't get to your questions, we are leaving you wanting more. Greg, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. It was really a terrific hour, and your report is, we've enjoyed the analysis, both in writing and what you've given us today. So thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for everybody for calling in.
Our next and final call of the semester before your finals and graduations will take place on Wednesday, April 25th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time, and we will be speaking with Blake Clayton, who is CFR's Fellow for Energy and National Security on energy dependence. In the meantime, I hope you'll go to our website, cfr.org, for daily updates on pressing foreign policy issues and video postings that we're doing. And the like. So thank you again for your participation, and we look forward to having you join us for the last call in the semester.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.